to really step out and investigate these leading upcoming materials.
Hello, construction industry professionals. You're listening to The Art of Construction, specifically designed for contractors and architects to help grow your business. Here are your hosts, Devin and Kevin.
So, Kevin, we're going to dive in and have a fireside chat with Laura Bartels and David Eisenberg. Great introduction that we got from Lindsay Love from Love Shack Architecture, who's very passionate about the sustainability. And we're going to go in and talk a little bit about building a house out of straw bales and some details of why they're thinking about that. So if you're into the sustainability codes and unique conversations about that, this is the show for you.
And we're going to hear a lot about their direct involvement in development of specific sections under the International Residential Code that deal with these specifically under subchapters R and S, I believe. So we'll hear a lot about that as we go.
Cool. So let's dive in and have a fireside chat and ask our leading questions to Laura and David.
Here we go.
So Laura, what's your favorite beverage?
Oh gosh, my favorite beverage might be right now kombucha.
All right.
Do you make your own or are you...
You know, I am just on the verge of making my own. I just got one of those starter things, and so I'm ready to jump in. Finally ready.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
I would say that it has to be Costa Rica at this point, off the top of my head. In 2005, I took my two sons. We traveled for almost a month, kicking around with the locals and really getting to know some local people, and kids made friends with boys in little towns and played soccer and went fishing. And we did a very non-touristy adventure. So it was a delight.
I'm jealous. That's one of my bucket list items of the full life perspective. If the people listen to that, Costa Rica is on that list. Tell us your favorite interest or hobby outside of the construction industry.
I would have to say hiking and exploring the mountains where I live. So I live in western Colorado, up in a small mountain town, and we are just blessed with so much land to explore. You could spend a lifetime right here in the mountains, hiking, skiing, exploring the backcountry.
All right, David, what is your favorite beverage?
At this point, that's a really good question because I like a lot of different things. It's probably coffee right now.
Awesome. And what is the favorite place or some favorite places you've traveled?
I really like New Zealand. I've been down there a couple of times, maybe three times. And it's a beautiful place. A lot of really wonderful people that I've encountered in New Zealand. And a lot of quite a varied climate on the two different islands. And it's a pretty special place.
Yeah, one of my favorites too. And outside of work, what is your favorite hobby or interest besides work?
I'd say my favorite since I was an adolescent is photography and nature photography and macro photography and taking pictures of lightning. And over the last dozen years or so, I've also started writing poetry on my photographs and sort of integrating the text into the images, and I'm pretty sure that's my favorite hobby in the past.
Awesome.
Cool. Well, we got to know a little bit about Laura and David, and we're going to talk about why we have them together into Studio AOC. But first, let's learn about Laura Bartels, the executive director of the Mindful Life Program. Laura, give us your 30-second elevator speech about what you do, and then we'll learn about David and how you guys all came together.
You may think it's odd that I'm the director of the Mindful Life Program and I'm on this podcast. And the reason, the short answer to my connection is that I had 20 plus years work in the sustainability and sustainable building realm. And in the last few years, made a shift from what I call outer sustainability to inner sustainability. And I'm excited to be bringing that now back to sustainability professionals. And for years, I was involved in alternative building technologies, building codes, working with Native American tribes, the EPA, really trying to push the envelope and leverage change towards sustainability and sustainable ways of building in particular.
Awesome. And let's get to know a little bit about David Eisenberg. David, give us a kind of a snapshot of what you do, and we'll go from there.
Well, I'm a recovering contractor, and I joke that it's more than a 12-step program for contractors. But basically, I had a little bit of a couple of years of architecture school at the University of Arizona way back when, and decided I wasn't going to be an architect. Ended up being a builder. Worked on some wild projects like building the cover of Biosphere 2 out in Oracle, Arizona. Ended up running, co-founding and running this nonprofit, the Development Center for Appropriate Technology, from about 1992 to through today, actually. And a lot of our work we got involved with early on in the early 90s with straw bale construction. I already had experience with rammed earth and adobe building. And those things led me into actually dealing with building codes, sort of a slippery slope. Straw bale was really the thing that pushed me over the edge into codes and standards. And much of our work has been involved with what we sometimes refer to as legalizing sustainability, because a lot of the most sustainable practices are not in codes and standards. And so it's been a long process of moving some of those things forward. We can talk more about that.
Well, and I think that's an important area maybe to launch from, and that is that as our listeners, which are, again, our ideal audience is really architects, builders that are looking to grow their business. And one of the things that's really critical these days is the whole focus on codes and code changes. So people may not be thinking of the fact that some of these sustainable types of building were not a part of the code. And so talk a little bit about kind of the genesis of what started that and kind of where it's come up to this point.
Sure. Well, so, I mean, it is interesting. If you look at the 2015 International Residential Code, there are two appendices, R and S, that are for light straw clay construction and straw bale construction. It's nice that straw bale is Appendix S. Makes it easy to remember. But it took about 20 years, actually, to evolve straw bale building codes to the point where they could gain acceptance in sort of mainstream code, in the mainstream building code. So along the way, we were involved in a lot of both development of building straw bale building systems and testing and a lot of different projects, mostly sort of consulting capacity. But eventually, it got to the place where we actually knew enough to be able to start proposing really good code language for those things. And for me, early on, I was involved in teaching straw bale workshops, and that's something that Laura and I did together a number of times. I started seeing fairly early on in the early 90s that it felt like we were kind of seducing people into thinking they could build a straw bale house, and then they would run into problems getting their building permits. So I started thinking, well, we need to do something about that. Here in Tucson, the city of Tucson and Pima County actually worked with us. We approached them, and then over several years, we worked on developing what was the first load-bearing straw bale code. And that eventually got legislatively adopted as a voluntary code in California. There are lots of issues along the way. In doing that, I started to get very directly involved with building code officials, working with them in a non-adversarial way, developing a lot of really great relationships that were useful. I was also on the National Board of Directors of the U.S. Green Building Council back in 2000 through 2005, I think. And I founded the USGBC Code Committee and chaired it for the 9 years of its existence, and then was able to negotiate an agreement, a memorandum of understanding between USGBC and the International Code Council to work together, which I got to sign in 2007. And that year, both ICC gave DCAT their Affiliate of the Year award, And we also got a National Leadership Award from the U.S. Green Building Council, basically for about a decade's worth of work, bringing those two organizations together to work together. It's been a really interesting experience, and I also spent 5 years as the vice chair of an ASTM subcommittee on sustainability for buildings, which is now E60, that committee E60. But during that time, we developed the first ASTM standard for earthen wall systems. It's ASTM, is it E20? I think it's 2392. It's a standard guide for the design of earthen wall systems, I believe is the title.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that introduction, David. On, we got to learn a lot about you've been very involved in the codes and the changes on sustainability along the way. And I like to tie our shows together and give credit where credit's due. And we got the introduction from Laura, who's in Colorado, and David, who's in Arizona, who similar but very different markets and climate, things like that. Show 53, titled "The Architecture is the Medium Through Which We Experience Our World," we got the introduction to them from Lindsay Love. Go back and listen to that show. And she was actually a student or apprentice on a project with Laura on the straw bale home. So, Laura, tell us about that experience and kind of paint the picture on how straw bale has come together, and give us some examples and things along the way how Lindsay was put into your work.
Well, quick history. So in 1994 and 5, I did the first code-approved straw bale home in at least western Colorado, maybe all of Colorado, who knows at that point. So trial by fire, jumping in, learning codes from the owner-builder perspective of wanting to do something that they'd never heard of. So then fast forward from that project, which was a wonderful project, a lot of exposure, a lot of volunteers from six or so different states, learned a lot, and that's what catapulted me into this whole realm of alternative building materials and straw bale construction specifically. But then in 2010, I was ready to build something in town. That first project was way up on a mountain pass, 8,200 feet in elevation, a pretty rough road to get there, but it was beautiful, beautiful location. But in 2010, ready to do something in town on a little lot I had bought a number of years prior to that. And I knew how much energy it took. And so I really wasn't willing to do a project unless I really milked it for all of its value, which for me is education and giving people experience and stuff. So I did it as a demonstration project. The idea of the whole project was to really be able to push limits and try things, put some things together that maybe hadn't been put together before. And so we're really looking to do very low impact, non-toxic, local materials as much as possible. Part of the design of the demonstration project was to be able to both bring in interns to work on the project 2 to 6 months at a time, whatever fit for them. And so I had a wonderful group of people rotating through over the time that we were doing the project. And Lindsay was one of them. Lindsay had already become an architect. She had been working for an architectural firm down in Santa Fe, and then with a group out of Moab called Community Rebuilds. It was through that project that she heard about me and the project I was doing. And so she applied for an internship, and it was a wonderful match. She had already had hands-on experience as well as architectural experience. So it was fun to bring her in. During the time we were together, we were both hands, you know, everyone was hands-on on the project, but we would also do lunchtime lessons. There was a lot of reading material for all the interns, and our lunchtime class time was largely focused on building science. So we really went through a wide range of different thinking around building science than she may have learned in her architectural schooling. Typically, I find that when we're really bringing building science with alternative materials, it's something that gets people to really have to shift the way they're thinking. Typically, contractors and architects are taught to think a little bit differently. So it was a great piece to bring to them. I had a wide range of interns, from older man in the energy efficiency realm to a young woman with no formal schooling but some hands-on experience. And so, yeah, it was a great experience. And that project, we We did things like had the least amount of concrete in the foundation that the engineers had ever seen. They now use it in presentations that they do. We used sheep's wool insulation, bat wool. That led to a local insulation company getting so excited that they invested in the manufacturing equipment to turn wool into local sheep's wool here into bat insulation and sell it in this market. It was a fabulous and fun project. David was up helping at several points during it, as well as a lot of other people as well. So
it's so cool. I love hearing the education part of it. And me as a business owner, I'm always tying it back to the business part of it, which education and business and value engineering and sustainable building is so important. But yet I think sometimes people lose that connection of the forever home and those types of things when dollars get put into the realm, because a lot of times it's not the lowest cost way to do it. So I'd love for you guys both to kind of talk about that, as you guys have been living this for quite a while now. I commend you and Lindsay for pushing us on the Art of Construction to say, you guys need to be on this, have them on the show and talk about sustainable living. And she's passionate about the straw bale home. And I think that's really what makes her be memorable and sets her apart. So I would love for you both, starting with David, to talk about the money, quote unquote, part of sustainable living when you're getting into codes and getting things to not come from a conversation, but to reality.
Yeah, well, the financial aspect of all this is quite interesting and involved. Certainly, if you look at a lot of, particularly in the, you really see affordability showing up in the residential code as an issue. Part of our experience, of course, in working with code officials is that they've had a fairly tight focus on life safety issues. So things like affordability have been secondary, and in their view, a lot of alternatives can either be more or less expensive. It sort of depends. Clearly, one of the big early draws, and it was somewhat deceptive, I think, for straw bale construction, was some information that sort of got out there, which was had to do with the really the cost of a wall system being projected out into this idea that you could build a straw bale house insanely cheaply, which, of course, when you realize it was only a wall system, there's a limit to how much it could impact the overall cost of a whole house. So there was a lot of mythology around this incredible idea that you could build a house so cheaply. Part of that came from the fact that there were a number of people who were owner-builders who did almost all the work themselves and salvaged materials and, et cetera, and they built very cheaply, but that's not the way most people can build or have to build. And then when people have to build to code, a lot of those houses were built in places with no or minimal code enforcement. A lot of these alternatives are looked at also just from a first cost standpoint. And when you think about a lot of these things, their benefits accrue over time, not just in the initial cost. We've done a lot of work in the affordable housing realm. And one of the things that comes clear pretty early on in working there is that affordability is not just, the mortgage payment or the first cost of building something, but you actually have to be able to pay for the utilities and maintenance and all the rest. We've also done a lot of work, and maybe we'll have time to talk a little bit about our work with Native American tribes. And you really see that on a lot of Indian reservations around the country, that people get houses that are not particularly well designed or built and are very expensive to heat and cool, and they can't afford, the utilities, and they can't. That generally makes the maintenance issue way more expensive as well. There's really an integrated aspect to, looking at the economics. For builders and for designers, it's really important to actually pay attention to life cycle costs as well as first cost. There are some things around like energy efficient mortgages, et cetera, that actually enable people to invest a little more in the money available for the construction costs because there's a recognition that their utility bills will be lower, so they'll have more financial ability to spend a little more on the mortgage to get those energy efficiency benefits.
So, Laura, how would you explain, since you've specifically have done a couple of cool projects, we have been searching online and all kinds of cool pictures and stuff come up that we can compile and put into the show notes, but of doing a couple of the projects, when it comes to the cost associated with sustainability, what would you talk to on that note?
Well, that's a big question in terms of, you know, if you just put it all into this question of sustainability. Let me get very specific in terms of sort of a architect-client relationship and some of the motivations and some of the things I see happen in that relationship. And that is that sometimes when people are, we get attached to a vision and we want to put that into place. And sometimes we think it needs to be a lot more complicated than it really is. It speaks to the general tendency for clients to have this vision and be sort of locked into this picture and not realize that what we get driven to is often a larger home, a more complicated home, then we really need to be actually quite happy. When I was teaching, I would talk about every added square foot you put on your house, that's first cost, construction cost, that's maintenance, that's repair cost, and that's cleaning, it's all these things over the life of the home. And so, you know, we were always sort of guiding people to smaller and simpler. So I think if you get back to basics, I think that's one of the first places that projects can go sort of off track. And it really does speak to sustainability in the sense that we often tend to think we need this to be happy. And now I'm also speaking a little bit from my mindfulness perspective too, but we really can get caught up in this vision, this attachment to thinking that if I do this, this is really what's going to make my life happy. It's going to be really what I need. And it's interesting. I think when we get down to our real values and we look at overall lifestyle choices, we start to see that having a particular size house with all these features to it is a piece of an overall life. And that we can, if we guide our clients back to the picture, the bigger picture of their life, that we can help them sort of get some balance in that picture. So I think that's sort of foundational to the sustainability piece in terms of our appetite and our attachments to some of the things that we look for. But in terms of actual costs for building, let's say in straw bale construction, as I was doing a lot of consulting, what we're talking about is looking at a couple things. One is, first, to build with this material and these thick walls, that we end up having a very tight building envelope that's energy efficient unto itself. And when you take these materials and blend it with a nice passive solar design, that becomes the basis for your sustainability and your energy efficiency in the home. The house that I live in right now is so efficient with just the basics of the straw bale envelope, super insulated foundation and roof system, very tight construction, compact design, and a nice passive solar design, that here I am in the Colorado Rockies, I have been able to reduce costs in my boiler system. I don't even have heating elements at all of any kind in the upstairs of the home because it's just not needed. We have just a radiant floor tubing downstairs, and we lived in the house for a year or two and realized that we didn't even need to add the radiators upstairs. So I think when we start to talk simplicity of design and really looking at the foundational pieces, we start to see that focus can help us reduce the costs. In terms of a solar hot water system right now, for heating, it's not even cost effective at this point because the house is so efficient. So it's an interesting thing in terms of just, I guess my message is getting back to basics and getting back to really looking at the bigger picture of our lives so that we're making core and foundational decisions from the start about a sustainable picture in terms of not having too big of an appetite. I think, and I'm speaking from, I live in an area where that is so prevalent. So we see around here, we see 6,000 square foot homes that are, quote, supposed to be sustainable. But, you know, what have we put into it just to get the structure up in the first place? I guess I'm really trying to bring us back to that sort of foundational piece of our perspective and our attitudes about, you know, what we need to be happy.
That's a good kind of outlook of the whole system. And then, David, off air, you'd mentioned that you worked on a straw bale constructed facility that was for a corporate office back in Pennsylvania. Maybe you could give our listeners a little insight on that.
Yeah, we want to give us a quick description, and then I think our audience would be curious to know some of the building techniques as far as how you stucco to it, windows and doors, how you build walls around that, as I'm looking at all kinds of cool pictures. So I'd love to, David, you give an example, and then you guys kind of talk through the methods on this.
Before we go there, I just want to add one more thought around the issue of costs and some of what Laura was just talking about, you know, the size of houses. And that is sort of on the other extreme end from the 6 or 10,000 square foot house. We were involved in getting a tiny house appendix approved just within the last few weeks, actually, for the 2018 International Residential Code. And hopefully we'll have time to talk a little bit about that. The project in Philadelphia was actually, initially the owners were interested in potentially doing their whole warehouse using straw bale, but for a variety of reasons, it ended up being reduced to just their office and conference room area. And actually, Laura was more directly involved in the plastering and some of the construction for that project. And actually, Laura also early on had her own plastering sort of stucco business for straw bale construction. We can talk about some of those details. I would put out there, though, that there are some really wonderful resources along those lines that are out there. There's a wonderful book, The Natural Building Companion, by Jacob Deva Rakusin and Ace McCarlton, which is very useful. Chris Magwood, a Canadian architect and teacher and researcher, has written several excellent books on straw bale building. And he's also written another book that is extraordinarily useful for designers and builders. It's called Making Better Buildings, A Comparative Guide to Sustainable Construction for Homeowners and Contractors. It's a New Society publishing book that's a fabulous resource. And maybe I'll let Laura talk a little bit about the specifics of that Arizen project in Philadelphia.
Sure. Yeah, David and I were both brought in as consultants in the design phase of this corporate headquarters. Yeah, they had some pretty ambitious goals for the design. So we were brought in to consult on how to integrate the straw bale exterior wall system with the rest of the building, the detailing of it. And we spent time drawing a lot of details for them, consulting on some of the issues, looking at the structural relationship to the wall system, and looking at a lot of the plaster choices. They really wanted to push some limits as well in terms of using local materials. We ended up actually having a really wonderful turn of events where we did use a lime plaster on the exterior. On the interior, the finish coat, final color and finish coat, came actually from the excavated soil for the building itself. Turns out that when I did some tests with it, it was a really wonderful clay that would make a very good plaster. And then just by chance, not far from the construction site, there was a clay processing plant. So they were able to actually take dump truck loads of this material down to the processing plant. They sifted it and heated it, sifted it again. They ended up actually creating a bagged clay for them out of this material. What was really fascinating was when they heated it, and it wasn't to a very high temperature, but when they heated it to dry it, to pulverize it even more, they actually changed the color of the clay. So the heat itself transformed the color to this beautiful sort of yellow ochre color. And therefore, when we made the plaster, which, you know, they sent it out, I would have 50-pound pails of dirt sent to me, and my UPS driver was quite confused every time I'd get this big pail of dirt delivered. But what I was doing was taking this and then developing their plaster recipe for them. We were able to use the natural color of the clay and no pigment at all. So it was really wonderful use of what would have been, you know, waste material, the excavated soil from the site itself. In this process, and I think this sort of demonstrates some of the learning curve that goes on in an alternative material like this. Through the design stage, here they have David and I come in as consultants on the design. So we're working with their architects and engineers. And then when we get into the construction, then we're working directly with the contractor and training their employees, basically, on installing the straw bales, detailing them, as you guys have asked about, detailing for openings, windows and doors, things like that, and then preparing for plaster. So we walk them through all these stages. They had me fly out. I think I was out there at two different stages and leading trainings for both their construction crew, and then they brought in a stucco contractor, and then I flew out and worked alongside them as well to get them comfortable with this material. I mean, they bring so much skill to the process, but it's a matter of sort of translating what they know and applying it to working with this different material. And so that's the role that I played a lot, and David, I know, has played a lot in terms of sort of being a support system for people to learn these materials, learn these processes, learn the how to detail them for air sealing, for water at windows and doors, things like that. And then consult on the kinds of plasters we can. There's the range from a cement stucco to a cement lime to a lime earth to a straight earth plaster. So you have this sort of really wide range, and that's where the building science really comes in. And looking at the permeability of the plaster systems, looking at cost, looking and things like that, but really looking at what makes these wall systems work. And we want protection, but we want the vapor permeability rating to be as high as possible with maintaining weatherproofing, the protection on the skins of the building. So it's a different system than trying to keep all water vapor, all moisture out completely, but knowing that we may see some wetting of the exterior plasters, and what we want to maintain is a very good drying potential. So we actually have a wall that doesn't breathe. That's the misnomer or the misperception that we want it to be breathable. We actually don't want air to be passing through for the energy efficiency end of things. We want a nice air seal, but we do want these wall systems to be vapor permeable. And so as much as we can tend towards a lime or an earthen plaster, we get up to the higher permeability ratings. And also the nice thing is we get the higher permeability ratings and we get the lower impact. So in terms of carbon footprint, it gets much lower from concrete to or cement stucco to a lime plaster. And then again, from a lime plaster to an earthen material, much lower carbon footprint.
Well, that's so excellent. You guys have so much knowledge when it comes to sustainability. And this show, we could talk all day long because you guys have so much great information. But that's what's cool about the podcast is we dangle the carrot and then you can go back to the show notes that we will gather the information from Laura and David and put links and information to if it's straw bale codes, all that kind of stuff that they have really lived this stuff that can get very confusing. You got to go back to these confusing elements and find experts experts like David and Laura. So we always like to end our show as a learning organization. If there's one thing that you want to leave for contractors and architects over the years, give us one thing that we can take to the business bank to grow your business. Laura?
I would say to really step out and investigate these leading upcoming materials, which whether it's straw bale or other materials or systems, that really helps you be a leader in moving things forward. I think if you look at the values that you hold as you get into being an architect or a contractor, wanting to provide good buildings and a really healthy built environment for this and future generations, I would say it really comes down to being a leader and stepping out and getting to learn about these materials and try them out. Get your hands on and really get out there and get involved.
Excellent. Thanks, Laura. David?
Similar to what Laura was saying, really pay attention. Try and set aside some time to be looking at kind of emergent trends and technologies. I'm always interested in things that aren't, our organization is a development center for appropriate technology. And appropriateness has to do with a lot of things, but it really has to do with looking at comprehensive, understanding of what the benefits and the impacts are of what you're doing. There are a lot of excellent information resources out there. I have a whole list of resources, websites, books, etc., that will provide to give guidance to people who are interested in exploring more of these things. Certainly be happy to share any of that information.
Excellent. Thank you so much, David and Laura, for coming into Studio AOC. And hopefully we have shed some light on all your great knowledge and things that you put together. And we'll make sure to have great show notes so you can tell your tribe about this to grow the education of the construction industry. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you both.
What a wealth of knowledge and expertise when it comes to sustainability, code. I loved her comment about outer sustainability to inner sustainability. And that's what's really cool about the construction industry and the full life perspective. A lot of things that they can talk, at length and detail, so much wealth, right?
No, absolutely. And the other thing that's fascinating to me is you have all this outward pressure from all these building entities, the cities and the municipalities that want everybody to build in a way that's more sustainable, more energy efficient. And yet here's an avenue that's been around for, quite honestly, centuries and even in modern times been actively used in construction for the last 30, 40, 50 years. And yet at the same time, hasn't quite lined up with traditional building from a code standpoint. So you could build this way a lot of times, but it wasn't right in the code. And these experts have worked diligently to help adjust and change that. So now it is part of the international residential code. So,
yeah, and I commend them. It's not easy to do stuff different, to go another avenue than the status quo. And I give Laura and David credit for living that life of pushing the envelope. And it's been really fun that we have a whole network of people, and I can't wait for this show to go out to that network of people in the sustainability and the green building, from Scott Rodwin to Love Shack Architecture. We've had several people into Studio AOC that are passionate about this. So I'm excited for Laura and David to tell their friends and have the Art of Construction keep pulling all these networks together. And as we're all working together, it makes us that much stronger for education in the construction industry.
No, absolutely. And as you indicated at the end of the show, Devin, there's so much information. We could have stayed on this subject for hours, but we will have some detailed notes on the show notes page that'll provide some resources that people that are interested in this can reach out and get more information on as well. So,
cool. Well, thanks for listening, and talk to you soon here in the Art of Construction.
You have been listening to the Art of Construction, specifically designed for contractors and architects to help grow your business. To listen to more, please go to www.mtnview.us and click on the podcast tab. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, and thanks for listening.